Ryan.com.
And support for this wonderful radio station, support for WMNF comes from you, our fabulous members in Florida Southern College, encouraging visitors to experience the world's largest collection of Frank Lloyd Wright architecture with a guided campus tour. Tour reservations and details can be found at flsouthern.edu/FLLW. Good afternoon. You are listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM, the best little station in the whole damn nation, otherwise known as the last local radio. We appreciate you so much for listening. It's really awesome. If you are interested in going to tomorrow night's concert, the Alt Country Hoedown, the doors open at 5. The music starts at 6. The music is insane. There's the Oak Hill Drifters are playing. Jason D. Williams, if you've never seen him, you are missing out on life. I think years ago I saw Jerry Lee Lewis, and everyone's like, oh, you got to see Jerry Lee Lewis. And I'm really glad I saw him, but it was at the end of his really performing career, so it was pretty quiet. But I feel like the first time I saw Jason T. Williams must have been what people felt like when they saw Jerry Lee Lewis, because he is on fire. After that is Dale Watson, My Pretend Boyfriend. I love him. Nikki Lane is coming in after that. And then Reckless Kelly. You can call 813-238-8001 to get tickets, or go online to WMNF.org to get tickets. We're going to get started with some music here on Art in Your Ear. My name is Joellen Schilke. I am the host who loves you the most. How about You're Golden?
It's not what you do in a day. It's not what you wanted to say. It's not that you wear. Bear in mind, you're golden, caught up in my, you've stolen my heart.
That is the Polyphonic Spree. You're golden. You are. Well, thanks for listening to 88.5 Art in Your Ear. One of the, there's two things. One, if you have ever had to sell an unwanted vehicle, which I have, it can be a hassle. But donating it to WMNF is easy. Simply provide a clean title and we will take care of the pickup and the donation receipt. To get started, call 1-888-966-3885 or go to WMNF.org. So yeah, actually it's amazing. People donate their vehicles to us and they get sold. And what happens is you get a receipt for your taxes and we get the donation. And then that car that has been driving you crazy because you stare at it every single day is gone. So it is pretty much a win-win. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot for me, and then a conversation I had with someone last night, a friend last night, about what is he doing for his creativity? What is he going to do? He's so talented and doesn't use it. Made me think of a talk that I listened to, a TED talk that I listened to not that long ago. I'm not sure when it's from. I think it's, you know, it's not that old. Anyway, it was called, it's by Tim Harford, who I've played before here on the station. And I want to play this for you. It's called A Powerful Way to Unleash Your Natural Creativity. And so this is for everybody who knows that they have something to do and say and work on and are kind of paralyzed from doing it. This is Tim Harford, A Powerful Way to Unleash Your Natural Creativity. Thanks for listening to Art in Your Ear on 88.5.
To do two things at once is to do neither. It's a great smackdown of multitasking, isn't it? Often attributed to the Roman writer Publius Syrus, although you know how these things are. He probably never said it. What I'm interested in, though, is it true? I mean, it's obviously true for emailing at the dinner table or texting while driving or possibly for live tweeting a TED talk as well. But I'd like to argue that for an important kind of activity, doing two things at once, or three, or even four, is exactly what we should be aiming for. Look no further than Albert Einstein. In 1905, he published four remarkable scientific papers. One of them was on Brownian motion. It provided empirical evidence that atoms exist, and it laid out the basic mathematics behind most of financial economics. Another one was on the theory of special relativity. Another one was on the photoelectric effect. That's why solar panels work. It's a nice one. Gave him the Nobel Prize for that one. And the fourth introduced an equation you might have heard of, E equals mc squared. So tell me again how you shouldn't do several things at once. Now, obviously, working simultaneously on Brownian motion, special relativity, and the photoelectric effect, it's not exactly the same kind of multitasking as Snapchatting while you're watching Westworld. Very different. And Einstein, he's Einstein. He's one of a kind, he's unique. But the pattern of behavior that Einstein was demonstrating, that's not unique at all. It's very common among highly creative people, both artists and scientists. And I'd like to give it a name. Slow motion multitasking. Slow motion multitasking feels like a counterintuitive idea. What I'm describing here is having multiple projects on the go at the same time, and you move backwards and forwards between topics as the mood takes you or as the situation demands. But the reason it seems counterintuitive is because we're used to lapsing into multitasking out of desperation. We're in a hurry. We want to do everything at once. If we were willing to slow multitasking down, we might find that it works quite brilliantly. 60 years ago, a young psychologist by the name of Bernice Ageson began a long research project into the personalities and the working habits of 40 leading scientists. Einstein was already dead, but four of her subjects won Nobel Prizes, including Linus Pauling and Richard Feynman. The research went on for decades. In fact, it continued even after Professor Ageson herself had died. And one of the questions that it answered was, how is it that some scientists are able to go on producing important work right through their lives? What is it about these people? Is it their personality? Is it their skill set? Their daily routines? Oh, Well, a pattern that emerged was clear, and I think to some people surprising. The top scientists kept changing the subject. They would shift topics repeatedly during their first 100 published research papers. Do you want to guess how often? 3 times? 5 times? No. On average, the most enduringly creative scientists switched topics 43 times in their first 100 research papers. Seems that the secret to creativity is multitasking in slow motion. Ageson's research suggests we need to reclaim multitasking and remind ourselves how powerful it can be. And she's not the only person to have found this. Different researchers using different methods to study different, highly creative people have found that very often they have multiple projects in progress at the same time, and they're also far more likely than most of us to have serious hobbies. Slow motion multitasking among creative people is ubiquitous. So, why? I think there are 3 reasons, and the first is the simplest. Creativity often comes when you take an idea from its original context and you move it somewhere else. It's easier to think outside the box if you spend your time clambering from one box into another. For an example of this, consider the original Eureka moment. Archimedes, he's wrestling with a difficult problem, and he realizes in a flash he can solve it using the displacement of water. And if you believe the story, this idea comes to him as he's taking a bath, lowering himself in, and he's watching the water level rise and fall. And if solving a problem while having a bath isn't multitasking, I don't know what is. The second reason that multitasking can work is that learning to do one thing well can often help you do something else. Any athlete can tell you about the benefits of cross-training, but it's possible to cross-train your mind too. A few years ago, researchers took 18 randomly chosen medical students and they enrolled them in a course at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where they learned to criticize and analyze works of visual art. And at the end of the course, these students were compared with a control group of their fellow medical students, and the ones who had taken the art course had become substantially better at performing tasks such as diagnosing diseases of the eye by analyzing photographs. They'd become better eye doctors. So if we want to become better at what we do, maybe we should spend some time doing something else, even if the two fields appear to be as completely distinct as ophthalmology and the history of art. And if you'd like an example of this, should we go for a less intimidating example than Einstein? Okay, Michael Crichton, creator of Jurassic Park and ER. So in the 1970s, he originally trained as a doctor, but then he wrote novels, and he directed the original Westworld movie. But also, and this is less well known, he also wrote non-fiction books about art, about medicine, about computer programming. So in 1995, he enjoyed the fruits of all this variety by penning the world's most commercially successful book and the world's most commercially successful TV series and the world's most commercially successful movie. In 1996, he did it all over again. There's a third reason why slow motion multitasking can help us solve problems. It can provide assistance when we're stuck. This can happen in an instant. So imagine that feeling of working on a crossword puzzle and you can't figure out the answer. And the reason you can't is because the wrong answer is stuck in your head. It's very easy. Just go and do something else. You know, switch topics, switch context, you'll forget the wrong answer, and that gives the right answer space to pop into the front of your mind. On the slower timescale that interests me, being stuck is a much more serious thing. You get turned down for funding. Your cell cultures won't grow. Your rockets keep crashing. Nobody wants to publish your fantasy novel about a school for wizards. Or maybe you just can't find the solution to the problem that you're working on. And being stuck like that I mean, stasis, stress, possibly even depression. But if you have another exciting, challenging project to work on, well, being stuck on one is just an opportunity to do something else. And we can all get stuck sometimes, even Albert Einstein. 10 years after the original miraculous year that I described, Einstein was putting together the pieces of his theory of general relativity, his greatest achievement. And he was exhausted. And so he turned to an easier problem. He proposed the stimulated emission of radiation, which, as you may know, is the zr in laser. So he's laying down the theoretical foundation for the laser beam. And then, while he's doing that, he moves back to general relativity, and he's refreshed. He sees what the theory implies, that the universe isn't static. It's expanding. It's an idea so staggering, Einstein can't bring himself to believe it for years. Look, if you get stuck and you lay the ball, you get the ball rolling on laser beams, you're in pretty good shape. So that's the case for slow motion multitasking. And I'm not promising that it's going to turn you into Einstein. I'm not even promising it's going to turn you into Michael Crichton. But it is a powerful way to organize our creative lives. But there's a problem. How do we stop all of these projects becoming completely overwhelming? How do we keep all these ideas straight in our minds? Well, here's a simple solution, a practical solution, from the great American choreographer Twyla Tharp. Over the last few decades, she's blurred boundaries, mixed genres, won prizes, danced to the music of everybody from Philip Glass to Billy Joel. She's written 3 books. I mean, she's a slow motion multitasker, of course she is. She says, you have to be all things. Why exclude? You have to be everything. And Tharp's method for preventing all of these different projects from becoming overwhelming is a simple one. She gives each project a big cardboard box, writes the name of the project on the side of the box, and into it she tosses DVDs and books, magazine cuttings, theatre programmes, physical objects, really anything that's provided a source of creative inspiration. And she writes, "The box means I never have to worry about forgetting." One of the biggest fears for a creative person is that some brilliant idea will get lost because you didn't write it down and put it in a safe place. I don't worry about that because I know where to find it. It's all in the box. You can manage many ideas like this, either in physical boxes or in their digital equivalents. So I would like to urge you to embrace the art of slow motion multitasking. Not because you're in a hurry, but because you're in no hurry at all. And I want to give you one final example, my favorite example, Charles Darwin. A man whose slow burning multitasking is so staggering, I need a diagram to explain it all to you. We know what Darwin was doing at different times because the creativity researchers Howard Gruber and Sarah Davis have analyzed his diaries and his notebooks. So when he left school, age of 18, he was initially interested in 2 fields, so zoology and geology. Pretty soon, he signed up to be the onboard naturalist on the Beagle. This is the ship that eventually took 5 years to sail all the way around the southern oceans of the Earth, stopping at the Galapagos, passing through the Indian Ocean. While he was on the Beagle, he began researching coral reefs. This is a great synergy between his 2 interests in zoology and geology, and it starts to get him thinking about slow processes. But when he gets back from the voyage, his interests start to expand even further. Psychology, botany, for the rest of his life, he's moving backwards and forwards between these different fields. He never quite abandons any of them. In 1837, he begins work on 2 very interesting projects. One of them, earthworms. The other, a little notebook which he titles the transmutation of species. Then, Darwin starts studying my field, economics. He reads a book by the economist Thomas Malthus. And he has his eureka moment. In a flash, he realizes how species could emerge and evolve slowly through this process of the survival of the fittest. It all comes to him. He writes it all down. Every single important element of the theory of evolution in that notebook. But then, a new project. His son William's born. Well, there's a natural experiment right there. You get to observe the development of a human infant. So immediately, Darwin starts making notes. Now, of course, he's still working on the theory of evolution and the development of the human infant. But during all of this, he realizes he doesn't really know enough about taxonomy. So he starts studying that. And in the end, he spends 8 years becoming the world's leading expert on barnacles. Then Natural Selection, a book that he's to continue working on for his entire life. He never finishes it. Origin of Species is finally published 20 years after Darwin set out all the basic elements. Then The Descent of Man, controversial book. And then the book about the development of the human infant, the one that was inspired when he could see his son William crawling on the sitting room floor in front of him. When the book was published, William was 37 years old. And all this time, Darwin's working on earthworms. He fills his billiard room with earthworms in pots with glass covers. He shines lights on them to see if they'll respond. He holds a hot poker next to them to see if they move away. He chews tobacco and he blows on the earthworms to see if they have a sense of smell. He even plays the bassoon at the earthworms. I like to think of this great man when he's tired. He's stressed, he's anxious about the reception of his book, The Descent of Man. You or I might log into Facebook or turn on the television. Darwin would go into the billiard room to relax by studying the earthworms intensely. And that's why it's appropriate that one of his last great works is The Formation of Vegetable Mold Through the Action of Worms. He worked upon that book for 44 years. We don't live in the 19th century anymore. I don't think any of us could sit on our creative or scientific projects for 44 years. But we do have something to learn from the great slow-motion multitaskers, from Einstein and Darwin to Michael Crichton and Twyla Tharp. The modern world seems to present us with a choice. If we're not going to fast twitch from browser window to browser window, we have to live like a hermit, focus on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. I think that's a false dilemma. We can make multitasking work for us, unleashing our natural creativity. We just need to slow it down. So, make a list of your projects. Put down your phone. Pick up a couple of cardboard boxes. And get to work. Thank you very much.
Where I can go when I Hi, this is Olga Boff with a WMNF community announcement. Keep St. Petersburg Local's 6th annual Locotopia takes place on Saturday, February 2nd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Williams Park. Locotopia is St. Pete's largest community celebration of all things local with over 200 vendors. Details at keepstpetersburglocal.org/locotopia.
And WMNF supposed to have a table out at Localtopia, and I will be there. And if you are there, I hope you come say hi. We're a radio sponsor for that event, and I just admire everything they do. I have to tell you that. Hey, you just heard a talk from Tim Harford about powerful ways to unleash your creativity. Thank you for the emails about it. Tim Harford is his name, and basically saying you have lots of stuff going on, which is great. That makes me feel less scattered by knowing that's okay. A couple things going on, or more than a couple things. There's a ton of things going on here, and I want to let you know you're listening to 88.5 WMNF. We have, what should I tell you? Let's start with Studio 620. Studio at 620 in downtown St. Petersburg has a bunch of events going on this weekend and early next week. Saturday night is celebrating the legacy of James Baldwin. They're going to be showing one of the best movies that I saw, I guess it's 2 years ago now, I Am Not Your Negro. Great discussion coming after that with Dr. Julie Armstrong. This sounds really good. It's it's on Saturday morning, not Saturday night, 10 a.m. Saturday morning, and there's a donation accepted at the door for that. Also at Studio at 620, they have their radio theater project that started off as a WMNF thing and then segued as Sheila and the other people, Matt, involved, moved away from the station, but it's still a very, very, very good project. Radio theater is every single, it's on Monday nights. I think it's usually the last Monday of the month. So it'll be on this coming Monday, January 28th at 7 p.m. And they're doing three plays that sort of reference, they're women-centric plays, and then an adaptation of the 50s cult classic Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. So that should be really interesting. And that, again, is on Saturday night at 7 p.m. at Studio at 620. And lastly, they have a poetry open mic, and that's on the 30th. And that would be Wednesday night, and it's their monthly poetry open mic hosted by Keep St. Pete Lit. So everybody getting together, and that's at 7 p.m. at Studio at 620, and there is a admission fee at the door for that. Studio 620 is located at 620 First Avenue South in beautiful downtown St. Petersburg. You can go online to thestudio@620.org and see this and other information. So the next thing I'd like to play for you is a really interesting. A friend and I went to see some art the other day, and it made me think of this talk, so I thought I would play. This is Haley Levitt talking about what makes, who decides what art means.
Imagine you and a friend are strolling through an art exhibit and a striking painting catches your eye. The vibrant red appears to you as a symbol of love, but your friend is convinced it's a symbol of war. And where you see stars in a romantic sky, your friend interprets global warming-inducing pollutants. To settle the debate, you turn to the internet, where you read that the painting is a replica of the artist's first-grade art project. Red was her favourite colour, and the silver dots are fairies. You now know the exact intentions that led to the creation of this work. Are you wrong to have enjoyed it as something that the artist didn't intend? Do you enjoy it less now that you know the truth? Just how much should the artist's intention affect your interpretation of the painting? It's a question that's been tossed around by philosophers and art critics for decades, with no consensus in sight. In the mid-20th century, literary critic W.K. Wimsett and philosopher Monroe Beardsley argued that artistic intention was irrelevant. They called this the intentional fallacy, the belief that valuing an artist's intentions was misguided. Their argument was twofold. First, the artists we study are no longer living, never recorded their intentions, or are simply unavailable to answer questions about their work. Second, even if there were a bounty of relevant information, Wimsett and Beardsley believed it would distract us from the qualities of the work itself. They compared art to a dessert. When you taste a pudding, the chef's intentions don't affect whether you enjoy its flavour or texture. All that matters, they said, is that the pudding works. Of course, what works for one person might not work for another. And since different interpretations appeal to different people, the silver dots in our painting could be reasonably interpreted as fairies, stars, or pollutants. By Wimsett and Beardsley's logic, the artist's interpretation of her own work would just be one among many equally acceptable possibilities. If you find this problematic, you might be more in line with Stephen Knapp and Walter Ben Michaels, two literary theorists who rejected the intentional fallacy. They argued that an artist's intended meaning was not just one possible interpretation, but the only possible interpretation. For example, suppose you're walking along a beach and come across a series of marks in the sand that spell out a verse of poetry. Knapp and Michaels believed the poem would lose all meaning if you discovered these marks were not the work of a human being, but an odd coincidence produced by the waves. They believed an intentional creator is what makes the poem subject to understanding at all. Other thinkers advocate for a middle ground, suggesting that intention is just one piece in a larger puzzle. Contemporary philosopher Noel Carroll took this stance, arguing that an artist's intentions are relevant to their audience the same way a speaker's intentions are relevant to the person they're engaging in conversation. To understand how intentions function in conversation, Carroll said to imagine someone holding a cigarette and asking for a match. You respond by handing them a lighter, gathering that their motivation is to light their cigarette. The words they use to ask the question are important, but the intentions behind the question dictate your understanding and ultimately your response. So which end of this spectrum do you lean towards? Do you, like Wimsett and Beardsley, believe that when it comes to art, the proof should be in the pudding? Or do you think that an artist's plans and motivations for their work affect its meaning? Artistic interpretation is a complex web that will probably never offer a definitive answer.
WMNF is now available whenever and wherever you want it, thanks to the new WMNF smartphone app. Download it now for iPhone or Android smartphone. It's free. Now you never have to go without the great music and news of WMNF Community Conscious Radio.
Love me, consume me. I wanna be where love is.
As one way of relaxing, I write my poetry.
Go
I looked out the window one day at school, and I wrote my first poem. I must have been around 15, 16 years old in high school.
Yeah.
I was born in 1916.
Okay.
So. Okay, you can 16.
1932.
I have a grandson who's a real poet.
Lovers pressed into heaven with God thumbs. Articulated reaches of color. We are the song of blackbirds cast into skies, anonymous and true, hoping eardrums will rattle at our presence. We are manifest harmony. Sunset orange, putrid and cream wave, ochre dirt, red clay. We are days and days and days, locked like lips between which saliva drips like the last time we made it together. We thought that our hearts would beat right through thin bird rib cages, dance free from our bodies in that bedroom, right out the window. So we are love like God is love, like love is God, and the fingerprints can be easily identified on the sides of mountains ripped rigid from retreating waters, and in the frozen whirl of distant galaxies, double helix and typhoon, we are love, like generations walking unopened, unwrapped memories left forever to dust. See, we are the crust accumulating on the open mouths of rabid rodents, the sigh escaping the throats of martyred visionaries. We are, we be love like that, like 24/7, 365, 18 to 25 years, 25 million, 5 percenters, Kabbalah mystics, majority minorities, nature babies, seeing the eyes of the divine in the rings of trees. We be like that kind of love. See, we are love, limitless love, finicky love, laughable love, loaded on the ships for a long, slow trip, rocking like the diurnal ocean tide, the ebb and flow of bodies black and bright. We be love like light, love like knowing you are not alone in your despair, like the shimmering wheel in the middle of the air, conspiring with private demons, excavating bones locked in woodsheds and garages. We be love like halfway houses, free lunches, runaway shelters. Like the last time you saw her face, she had just turned 91 and was so happy to see you, she nearly forgot about the osteoporosis, pancreatitis, heart failure, back pain, and years you did not write because you were too busy. But the blessing was, it didn't matter. She smiled with eyes like oceans, showed you the last thing she painted, a landscape, mountains, some erstwhile V's indicating birds. And she said if you could remember how to trust in yourself again, honey, you could fly like that too. We are love like truth, pressed to the ground, crushed into chunks, ground into powder, liquefied and evaporated, still coming back in storm clouds that quench the dry earth. We are love like the songs of the risen forgotten, like Egypt living in the present, just in disguise. We are love like God in a mask. We are gods in our masks in love, loving like children love springtime, loving like light loves shadow, just enough to hold it, ever so delicately in place for those who cannot stand the heat of our day.
Is there any closing thoughts you'd like to leave the people with? Because this is going to be distributed maybe all around the world. And maybe something... Yeah, you might want to have someone to hear what you have to say. I'm not trying to frighten you.
Well, we trust that someday some of you may be poetry and be inspired by it.
Thank you.
That beautiful piece is by Reggie Eldridge. It features Diane Andrew, Elizabeth Shields, and Aisha Marshall. And I heard that. If you're a poetry fan, especially new modern poetry, we have a wonderful show on Sunday nights called Poetry Is. It's from 8 to 9 p.m. on Sunday nights, and they play such good poetry. And I heard that, and I was like, yeah, I'm totally stealing it. Stealing it and playing it on my show. Before that, there was, and thanks for the calls on it, there was a song by the OCs. They used to be O, the letter O and the letter C. Now they're not. Now they're the O, like an O, and C's, as in, I C's, what you doing? The OCs, and that was called Web. So I hope you're enjoying this. We're kind of on hold right now, switching from arts to news, is that President Trump is expected to make an announcement regarding the government shutdown. It's supposed to be at 1:30, but people are still waiting for him to come out. I believe it sounds like he's got something, a compromise maybe, or something that will reopen the government for 3 weeks. So stay tuned for that. Hopefully they'll be doing that. The newsroom is on standby to come in and do breaking news. It's so exciting. Something else going on around town. This is always fun if you want to do something with visitors or kids or just yourself. Single character performances that bring turn of the century hotel staff, members and guests to life is on Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Henry B. Plant Museum. And that is located at 401 West Kennedy Boulevard, Tampa. It's included with admission. And their phone number for more information is 813-254-1891. 813-254-1891. And we have, they generously gave us tickets to offer as a thank you present for people who pledge to Art in Your Ear. And we'll be putting those up online if you want to make some plans in that way. And I thank them so much for that. It's a wonderful place. It's where you see those big onion domes across from downtown Tampa for that. We do have a fun drive coming up in two weeks, whatever. February 8th is the day. I think that's the next government shutdown too. So please give before then, because I think that might be a stressful day for people. But but we do have a fun drive coming up. We've got to raise $2,400, at least $2,400, to maintain our position on the radio, and especially with program changes in the horizon. And I know there's some tweaks going on. We'd really like to stay where we are, and having a good fun drive is certainly a way to do that. I also want to let you know that there was something else. I'm going to go ahead and play you some more music, and then we're going to get out of here and wait for the president to see if the shutdown's going to end. Right now, this is some Hal Gelb, and it's the song Blood Orange.
See the sky broil and the color of a blood orange. I hear the cracking singe at the front metal screen door hinge. Staring at each other with a half-lit stone cold glare. Then fall into each other like the other is never even ever there. Lovers that know they're gonna hang, sweating bullets and reloading all over again. The winds have been banished, they have vanished like the shadows on the run. When it's hotter than a gun, barrels smoking in the sun. Midnight meat, touching like the blind, relying only on the feel.
See the skies as a royal color of blood orange. Hear the crackling singe of the metal screen door hinge.
Midnight meets is 101. So much never gets said or done. And the rain is a rumor. Over for its being.
And that's some Hal Gelb. A couple other things coming up, want to let you know about. After the NPR news, which is just in a minute or two, will be Seth Glier. He is our Glier, I think it's how it's pronounced. He's a nationally known folk pop singer, songwriter from Massachusetts, and he will be on the Live Music Showcase today. So stay tuned for that. They usually also broadcast it live on their Facebook page, Live Music Showcase WMNF, so you can watch it and listen if you want. Also, I want to let you know there's just great music coming up all through the day. Just stick with us. Great music all weekend. We're just lucky. I feel really lucky to have WMNF still. Something else going on, of course, it's Art Festival Temple Beth El this weekend. That's happening at Freefall Theater. They've got the opening of a new show. It's called A Perfect Arrangement, and it's a really interesting play about the intersection of LGBT lives in the 1950s and the Red Scare. So you can see that, and that's at Freefall Theater. Go to freefalltheater.com. You'll get more information. Anyway, I'm out of here. You've been listening to 88.5 WMNF Tampa, the last local radio. Thank you so much for listening. I'm losing because you got to go. Goodbye. Take care. You are listening to WMNF, and thank you for being part of us. Remember, we've got that fun drive coming up in a couple of weeks. Save your dollars.
Big boss man, can you hear?